relief factor, pain relief that's natural, pain relief that works, and pain relief that attacks the source of the pain. That's the experience of tens of thousands of Americans who are taking Relief Factor right now. See their incredible video endorsements at ReliefFactor.com and then order your three-week quick starter pack for just $19.95. That's less than a dollar a day. Find out if it can work for you like it works for me by ordering your three-week quick starter pack today. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Be the next success story.
Can't get enough of my dulcet tones. Want exclusive content that you can't find anywhere else, including my take on the real story behind the fake news. Join my cabinet, Gorka's Cabinet, today. Go to sebgorka.com, S-E-B-G-O-R-K-A.com. Click on the Gorka's Cabinet banner and join the most exclusive club out there for content you can't find anywhere else and the knowledge you need. Gorka's Cabinet at sebgorka.com. This is America First with me, Sebastian Gorka, and I'm very excited to introduce our guest host for today, founder of American Greatness, Chris Buskirk.
So we're talking about Doug Ducey's executive order re-shutting down parts of the Arizona economy. I live here in Arizona. Ducey is a Republican, really making a hash of this latest round of dealing with the virus, and it puts him on a collision course with the president, with Donald Trump. Why? Well, not just because the executive order that he signed is A, ineffectual, and B, self-evidently dumb, closing gyms and rivers. Make sure that we don't allow people to stay fit, and by God, don't allow them to get any sunshine because the virus, I guess. That's supposed to be the rationale. Now, meanwhile, what's open in Arizona? Well, casinos open. You know, we're protecting public health, right, in quotes. This is what the governor says. But the casinos are still open. McDonald's, still open. Marijuana stores, open. Abortion clinics, open. Those are all essential for public health in Doug Ducey's Arizona. But the gyms and the rivers are closed. And as a part of the executive order he signed, reshutting down some very targeted parts of Arizona, he said that he's delaying the reopening of public schools by 2 weeks, at least 2 weeks. Because what he said in the press conference is that the 2 week delay date, which puts it out to, I think it's August 17th, which will be 2 weeks later than scheduled, he said that's only a quote, aspirational date. In other words, stand by. We may push it back even later. But Donald Trump has taken the exact opposite position. Right. Donald Trump has said he wants to get the schools open right away. He thinks it's very important. And we've got a cut. This is cut two. If we could hear Donald Trump, what he has to say about getting the schools back open.
We hope that most schools are going to be open. We don't want people to make political statements or do it for political reasons. They think it's going to be good for them politically. So they keep the schools closed. No way. So we're very much going to put pressure on governors and everybody else to open the schools, to get them open, and it's very important. It's very important for our country. It's very important for the well-being of the student and the parents. So we're going to be putting a lot of pressure on open your schools in the fall.
He's absolutely right here. The schools have got to get open. There was a report out about a week ago that the head of the American Pediatrics Association was out saying that keeping the schools closed, keeping young kids out of school, was really, really detrimental to the students, that it was dangerous for them, that it was worse for them than the risk of contracting the virus it's worse for them than the risk of getting the virus by going to school. That you got to get kids in school, let them circulate. Their immune systems are very strong. They're robust. And they, not only do they need to learn, but there's a mental health aspect to it. There's a socialization aspect to it. And also, of course, then their immune systems come into contact with other things, which is normal, right? You can't live your life locked in a closet. But you heard the president saying, I'm going to put pressure on governors who are making political statements, trying to keep things closed. Well, he's got a Republican governor, one that he saw just 2 weeks ago. President Trump was out here in Arizona a couple weeks ago for a rally. I attended that rally. He needs to pick up the phone and he needs to get Governor Ducey on the line and ask him what he is doing because it is exactly the opposite of what the state needs. It's exactly opposite of what the president is trying to accomplish for the country. You know, it's interesting at the Trump rally a couple weeks ago, which, as again I said, it was really, really encouraging. The president was in fine form. I mean, it was a very upbeat crowd. People were excited to see him. And the president did what he always does at these rallies, which is, you know, he has a great rapport with the crowd, right? He has a speech, he kind of deviates from the speech and he'll riff a little bit. He kind of jokes back and forth with people. And one of the things he does is he acknowledges, you know, very publicly, as is the case in these type of situations, all of the Republican elected officials who were in the room there with him. So we had the governor, he was there, our one Republican state senator, she was there, Martha McSally. I think all of the Republican House members were there. And what Donald Trump does is he calls them out and he says, there's Representative Andy Biggs. Really great to see him. Love having him. And then there's a round of applause and whatnot. And he goes through each of them. And everybody got their round of applause, except when he got to Governor Ducey, who got booed. And this was before the executive order. And I thought, gosh, that's actually really interesting, right? This is a Trump crowd. And they, you know, they're there for the president, obviously. They really, really enjoyed seeing people like Andy Biggs, who I know has been on this program. They enjoyed seeing people like Paul Gosar, who's fantastic. You know, they cheered for Martha McSally, who's got a really tough race coming up. And then when they get to the governor, not so much. This is an issue for Republicans in the state of Arizona. And this is what, you know, a lot of people who watch these things worry, gosh, is Arizona going the way of Colorado? You know, that would be bad for Republicans in general, especially in presidential politics, but also in the House and in the Senate. You know, is Arizona, this is the question. I grew up here. Arizona was a deep red state. It's the state of Barry Goldwater. But is it going to become a pink state? Is it going to become a purple state? Is it going to become a blue state? I mean, Colorado is effectively a blue state, or at least a very purple, trending blue state. Does it happen to Arizona? And, you know, I'm very concerned about that, but not because the people of Arizona have really fundamentally changed. Yes, there's definitely been some drift because we've had, you know, so much illegal immigration, because we've had so much immigration from California, where people move here and they bring their, they don't like what happened in California, but then they move here to get away from it, but they bring the exact same political ideas with them. So those things have been a problem. But basically, what I've been thinking about this, I looked into it, and what's happened is that Doug Ducey, who was first elected as governor in 2014, has basically been a neutron bomb for the Republican Party in the state of Arizona. I mean, I went back and looked at what has transpired under his leadership here, and it is absolutely devastating. I mean, it is just frightening. And this, as I said earlier, this is a cautionary tale for Republicans in other states, and it's a wake-up call for Republicans in Arizona who need to rebuild from the devastation that Ducey has wrought on the Republican Party in Arizona. What do I mean? Let me give you an example. In January 2015, when Doug Ducey took office for his first term as governor, he's now in his second term, Arizona had nine congressional seats in the U.S. Congress. It was 5-4 Republicans. 5 Republicans, 4 Democrats. That's under his term in office. That has flipped. It's now 5 Democrats and 4 Republicans. Back then, in 2015, we had 2 Republican senators. We had John McCain, we had John Kyle. 2 Republican senators. Okay? Now, we have 1-1. Right? We have Kyrsten Sinema, who beat Martha McSally in 2018. And now we have Martha McSally, who got appointed to John McCain's seat, but she is trailing her Democrat opponent severely by double digits. She is very likely to lose that race. This is somebody that Doug Ducey appointed. So now what happens? So now we went from 2 Republican senators to 1, and very likely to 0 Republican senators, all based upon the actions of the governor. He will have had his fingerprints on the same person losing both Senate seats within 2 years. Okay, well, what about the state legislature? I'll give you an example there. The Arizona House, right, and our state legislature, in 2015, 36 Republicans, 24 Democrats. Right now, it's 31 Republicans and 29 Democrats, just one vote away from flipping, right? that's not good. It makes it very hard for Republicans to get things done because there are a couple of liberal Republicans in the Arizona State House. So we have seen over this time just the hollowing out of a Republican Party that once basically controlled the state. Well, how about other statewide electeds? Again, 2015, the Secretary of State, a Republican. The Secretary of State in Arizona is now a Democrat. 2015, the Secretary of State, or sorry, not the Secretary of State, but the Secretary of Education, a Republican. Now the Secretary of Education is a Democrat. How about in Arizona's largest county? That's the county that Phoenix and all of the suburbs of Phoenix sits in. It's got most of the population of the state in it. Well, in 2015, the sheriff of Maricopa County was a Republican. Now the sheriff of Maricopa County, which is an elected position, is a Democrat. How about the county recorder? A very, very important, kind of boring, right? But kind of a very important position because the county recorder has oversight of elections, right? Of what happens with ballots, of how the ballots get counted. And we all know what's gone on with those issues elsewhere. Well, back in 2015, when Ducey came into office, the county recorder, Republican, had been for years, like close to 20 years. Now, a Democrat. This is the sort of devastation that we have seen occur under Ducey's leadership of the Republican Party in Arizona. And it's something that is going to take a very long time to recover from. Right? We've got a lot of work to be done here. I want to think about how we do that, but what do we do right now to get Arizona back to normal? I'm Chris Buskirk. We'll be back with more of the Sebastian Gorka Show in just a few minutes.
This is America First, and I'm Sebastian Gorka. Let's get back to the show with Chris Buskirk.
So timing is everything in life, and just as we were going to the last break, Representative Kelly Townsend, who is a representative in the Arizona legislature here, gave me a call. And so I'm very happy to be joined by Representative Townsend to talk about what's been going on here in Arizona. Kelly, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, you guys.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, this is so important. I think it's important, obviously, for us as Arizonans. I also think it's important for other states, for people to learn. And what I've been saying is, you know, you look at other states that have Republican governors, you know, Texas or Georgia or South Carolina or whatever, lots of other states too, but, you know, they can watch and learn from what I think are some of Arizona's mistakes. And you've really been out front in calling on the governor to get the legislature back in session. The way the law reads here, you know, the governor obviously has powers to issue executive orders. That does not make them good or bad. It just means that they are allowed to do it. Power given to the governor by the legislature, but the legislature has been out of session, and you're saying we need to revisit this, right? There's an oversight role here that the legislature has that it's been prevented from doing. Is that sort of a fair characterization of your argument?
Well, I think that the legislators back in 2002, when they put this provision in statute, I don't know that they anticipated us being in a long-term shutdown, quote, emergency. And so I wish that they would have modeled it a little bit more like some of the other states where it says, okay, if there's an emergency, the governor has 30 days. And then after 30 days, he can extend it with the permission of the legislators. That brings the legislators to the table. He has to show that there's cause, that his efforts are effective, and they work together. And that's that check and balance. And, you know, we're not a monarchy. And even the monarch, you know, after the Magna Carta, they still have to go to Parliament, right? You know, one person cannot make unilateral decisions like this on the people, and especially when they're arbitrary and whimsical. So we're concerned. We want to be at the table. We did close the regular session with the anticipation of coming back for a special session right away. The governor, we had thought, was going to be calling us into that special session. That hasn't happened. So I'm currently working on seeing if we can get two-thirds of majority of the legislators to call ourselves in. Not sure that's going to be able to happen. We're going to need a bipartisan effort, and I'm hoping for that, but not sure that'll happen.
So when was the last time, just for people who aren't, you know, Arizonans who are listening, what was the last time that the Arizona legislature was in session? When did it wrap up?
Oh, goodness. It's been about a month now. It feels like I can't remember exactly what day it was. You know what? As a matter of fact, it was the end of May, like May 25th-ish, somewhere in there.
Yeah, it's 2020. It's okay. Nobody knows what day it is most of the time because time has taken on a totally different dimension. But the idea here is, and this was a big news story for people here, was yes, the regular session ended, but there was sort of an understanding that there would be a special session pretty quickly thereafter. But it seems like the governor has been super reticent to get the legislature back in session, perhaps to avoid revisiting the authority that was delegated to his office by the legislature.
Well, I don't presume to try and speak the motives of any person involved. You know, all I know is we have very serious issues that need attention. For example, there was some unfinished business in regard to the election. We had a bill that the counties put forward that has some conforming dates because we've moved the date of the primary. So that needs to happen. We have some other election integrity issues that we have to deal with, and that apparently is not going to happen in time for our primary, which our early ballots are going in the mail today. So, you know, we have some issues that are basic things that need to be done, let alone dealing with emergency powers of a governor. So I am insisting that we come back to the table like we were supposed to do. That's what we were promised, and it's not happening. And we just are caught in this dead zone of not knowing what to do. It's an election year. Everyone's very concerned. And, you know, so I think we need some serious leadership, and I'm not seeing it at all.
What's sort of the mood of the Republican caucus? You know, the Democrats are obviously going to do their own thing and have their own calculations. But in terms of getting the legislature back in session, sort of dealing with some of the issues you described, but also the governor's apparent desire to sort of have at least a partial re-shutdown of the state, how would you describe the feeling of elected Republicans in the legislature?
So I'm making the rounds talking to my colleagues. Every single person I have spoken with so far, except for one who's on the fence, I'm a little uncertain, but everyone else is very adamant. Yeah, we want to come back to work. We're out campaigning and all the rest, but our first primary job is to the people of the state. So it's not just me. I'm just the one being vocal about it. But everyone I've spoken to so far wants to sign the petition, wants to come back to work, is ready to go, willing to sacrifice in order to get this work done. We just can't until we get two-thirds of the House and two-thirds of the Senate. And we have a simple majority of the House right now, so we'd need at least 9 Democrats to join us in the House and at least 3 Democrats in the Senate, assuming all the Republicans are on board, which I think they will be, in order for us to come back. So it's going to take a bipartisan effort. And I'm hopeful. I know the Democrats have asked for a special session, so I'm just waiting for them to, you know, we sent out the petition today to put your signature on it. So I'm hopeful that it'll happen. And like I said, everybody seems to be motivated to come in and finish the work that we need to do.
Is there, I guess this is always a sort of a hard question, but maybe it's just sort of out there. I mean, what you're describing here is what you have to do in order to force the situation. But it could easily be solved if the governor was just to call a special session. Everybody, you know, and the legislature gets back in there. Do you have any sense, or has the governor said why he's not doing it?
I have not received any communication from his office to me directly. All I know is what I read in a local paper in the Arizona Capital Times. His spokesman misunderstood what we were wanting and said that it's irresponsible for us to set a date certain to end an emergency, saying after 30 days the emergency is over. And my answer was, if you'd had us at the table, we could explain to you that's not what we're asking. We're not asking you to put a time limit on an emergency. We are saying that after 30 days, like other states do, if the emergency still exists, it's become long-term now, and the impact on businesses and people is going to be significant. 30 days, as we have seen, is a long time for shutdowns and things like that. So if it's going on longer than 30 days, you need to have the legislature at the table to approve an extension.
Yeah,
and
absolutely
that
right.
Is
Representative
not unusual.
Townsend, we got to go to a break. Look, thank you so much for coming on the show on short notice. I think that's really, really helpful. It's important what's going on here in Arizona, and I know you're running for the state senate, so good luck with that. Representative Kelly Townsend.
The Trump campaign has a special offer just for you. President Trump wants to meet you. This will be the first opportunity he's had to meet with American patriots like you since our country started reopening. His team will cover the flight, hotel, and give you VIP access for yourself and a guest. He'll even take a picture with you. All you have to do is text VIP to 88022 today for your chance to meet President Trump. Again, that's VIP to 88022 to enter to win this contest and to join President Trump in the fight to keep America great for 4 more years. Paid for by Donald J. Trump for President, Inc.
On the side of the U.S. Constitution, America first.
If you want a better America, you have to build it. That's something that that I believe. And I've got a guest on with me right now who I think shares that sentiment and has some, I think, has some unique experiences in that regard and can be very helpful to understanding what we have to do and how maybe we can go about doing it. His name's Blake Masters. Blake is the chief operating officer of Teal Capital. He's got a background in venture capital investing. That is Teal, as in Peter Thiel, right, Blake, that with whom you co-authored a book, a great book, Zero to One, a couple of years ago. It was a huge bestseller. Yeah, Blake, look, there was an essay that was written a couple, well, I guess it's 2 months ago now, by Mark Andreessen, another venture capitalist, called it, I think it was called It's Time to Build. And you and I have talked about that a bit. And I guess if I can just sort of give the very short version for people who haven't written, haven't read it, it's, you know, it basically could maybe be summed up to say, yeah, we're not doing a remodel here. We gotta build from scratch, right? We can adhere to the same principles, but we gotta build newer, better, faster, stronger. And there's all kinds of things that need to be done. But if we want the country to be better, we've gotta build. We can't just repaint. Does that seem like a fair but very short description?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, Mark Andreessen, I think in that essay, gave a very cogent summary of what you might call the stagnation thesis, which is just in the past couple of decades, certainly the past two decades, some people would say it goes back to the 1970s, we've basically been technologically stagnant. We have not built enough new technology, you know, to sort of increase the standard of living and, you know, keep moving society to the next level. This is sort of counterintuitive to people because you kind of think, oh, well, we have the iPhone, we have all this technology, you know, and new computers and new IT equipment. But outside of that narrow cone of progress, you know, housing has actually just gotten sort of worse and more expensive. It's unclear that medical care has actually advanced all that much, especially relative to the high cost. So Andreessen's thesis, you know, which is something Peter has been saying for a long time, we actually live in a technologically stagnant society. It's pretty low growth, and it's time to build. If you want a better future, you know, it's not going to come just by rearranging pieces on the chessboard.
Wait, Blake, now I want to say something for people who maybe aren't familiar with the book Zero to One that you co-wrote with Peter Thiel, or maybe, you know, just have a general sense that when they hear Silicon Valley, which is, oh, Silicon Valley, they're obviously against everything I stand for. That's not you, right? I mean, you are part of a minority, though a smart and vocal minority in Silicon Valley that believes in America, that is broadly conservative, that wants to build and doesn't want to tear down. Having said that, I guess I put that out there a little bit as a disclaimer for people who might just kind of react to the Silicon Valley thing, because I was saying this earlier in the show, Blake, when Silicon Valley is doing what it should be doing, it really is good for the country, right? It's building new things that push the country forward. It's really new technology. It's not just sort of rat mazes, right, that produce dopamine hits for people who sit there staring at their screen all day long. It does something that actually makes people's lives better. And that's really what I think you're interested in doing. And so when you talk about the stagnation thesis, the first pushback I always get from people is, well, hold on a second, we got the iPhone. Right? What do you mean stagnation? Like, how would you, I guess, number one, explain the stagnation thesis? Like, what are some data points? And number two is, like, what's your best understanding of why it's happening?
Well, one fundamental distinction, one good cut at this, is the distinction between atoms and bits. You know, atoms are things in the real world. Technological improvement in the world of atoms means, you know, better healthcare. It means new anti-cancer therapeutics. It would mean better housing, better materials being developed, stuff that actually is tangible. And that's really where we've had the slowdown. A lot of stagnation in the world of atoms, not so much in the world of bits. You know, there's been a lot of innovation, so to speak, in IT, in computers, in internet, in software businesses. And a lot of that is really great. But a lot of that, as you said, is sort of just producing dopamine hits, is getting people addicted to social media, stuff that doesn't actually impact or improve in a meaningful way.
Hey Blake, can you hold that thought? We got to go to a break. Hold that thought, and we'll pick up on that on the other side. I'm Chris Buskirk. He's Blake Masters, and we'll be back after this message.
This is America First, and I'm Sebastian Gorka. Let's get back to the show with Chris Buskirk.
All right, welcome back. I'm Chris Buskirk. Blake Masters is my guest. He's co-author with Peter Thiel of the book Zero to One, which, by the way, I've read it a couple times. Read it. It is a very interesting book if you're interested in entrepreneurship and innovation, but read it the second time and you will realize there is a whole lot more there than meets the eye. That is my teaser for the book, Blake. Is that good enough?
Good enough. Plenty of hidden Easter eggs in that book if you want to find it.
There's a lot of hidden Easter. That's right. Blake, when we went to the break, we were talking about the stagnation thesis and the need to build new things, better things, things that actually make people's lives better, people that give America and Americans the edge. I get all this pushback, and I just want you to reiterate maybe a little bit of it, or maybe pick a different, an additional data point. Like, people say, like, well, we've got Facebook, we've got Twitter, we've got iPhones. What do you mean stagnation? Like, is there like a particular data point that you think that just kind of crystallizes it for people? And they're like, oh my gosh, I never thought about that. You're right.
Yeah, well, usually the way you get increased wages in a society is through increased productivity. And so technology, far from lowering people's wages, has the effect of making them more useful to their employer. You can get more work done, you know, per unit of time. And real wages have remained stagnant, if not fallen, in some sectors since the early 1970s. So you're looking at 50 years of no growth, or in some cases, you know, lowered wages. And that just shows, I think that brings into stark relief. Yeah, we've had tons of progress in terms of like Netflix and the internet. Now you can get 4K video on your phone. Your wages have gone down. You know, you're worse off than your parents were in a very material sense. I think that one data point just brings this home to people. A lot of innovation, have to concede, in internet and IT. We can debate how valuable that is. Not a lot of innovation in the world of atoms, and people kind of give all sorts of reasons and excuses for that.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? I mean, because there's there has been real advances in as you say, in bits and software and the things that kind of go around that. But that's kind of where it stopped. And so one of the things that we have seen is that people seem to live their lives through their screens, right? Parents are concerned about it. People are always kind of talking about it. We know it innately. In a sense, that's a reflection of the fact that that's where the technological progress has occurred. But on the other hand, you know, the data points I like are, you know, like the average speed of a commercial passenger jet is actually slightly lower right now than it was in 1965. Right? People don't, that's mm-hmm. you know, in the 60s, in the jet age, people would have thought by 2020, you know, it would take 15 minutes to get from New York to San Francisco. In fact, we've gone backwards. Or the fact that, for instance, the you know, median age, you know, the longevity of people, their lifespan has actually started to decline. You know, these are points where those are atoms things, right? That's where your real life outside of your screen occurs. And the question always is, why? Like, what happened? Like, is it, did we pick the low-hanging fruit? Are we focusing on the wrong things? And I know that's a really hard question, but like, what's your best cut at an answer on that?
I think the standard conventional answers are somewhat right. You know, certainly some low-hanging fruit has been picked. Sort of by definition, you're likely to discover the easy solutions first. And so maybe it's just kind of harder to innovate generally. People blame regulation a lot. This is the sort of standard libertarian conservative argument. You know, you can start a software company in your garage and write some code, and it's not that regulated. And so maybe you can build Pinterest or something like that. But, you know, if you try to improve on housing, or if you try to make a medical technology startup, obviously there's a lot more regulation in the world of atoms, and so that can retard progress. But what Mark Andreessen points to in his essay is this other sort of more intangible idea, which is we've lost the will to build, not even necessarily the technical know-how, but just the will to build. And I think there's something there. What Mark leaves out of his essay is, well, what kind of will would it take for sort of American entrepreneurs to build new and great things? I think that will is largely political. I think it's largely missing from Silicon Valley. And so if you're looking to make a fortune and you kind of don't want to, you know, go in some regulated space, maybe you do make a Pinterest and yet another social media app that people get addicted to. And you'll have some money to spend on your left-wing politics. And, you know, that's sort of a good way to claim some value. But if you really care, if you said, look at all these problems that we're seeing in America, and, you know, this is where the country is not doing as well as it should be. This is what we need to do. And some wider, more, maybe it's patriotic, maybe it's just looking at society and think, this is a problem, I'm going to attack that. Maybe you build a really different kind of company. Like I'd say, like Anduril, which, if you haven't heard of this company, Anduril is a border security, border technology company that tries to make our border patrol way more efficient through the use of automated technologies like drones and sensors and stuff like that. And so I really think it's this question of, why is anybody doing something? Are you doing something, you know, just to try to make money for yourself, or to try to support certain causes that Silicon Valley might find popular? Or are you doing it out of this sort of deeper sense of, I have some talent, I have some skill, I'm willing to work hard, and, you know, I'm going to solve this really important problem? And I think too few entrepreneurs think of it like that.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, Elon Musk has sort of captured people's imagination, but he deals mostly in the world of atoms, and maybe that's part of why. I mean, you know, building rockets that go into space is cool. Building, you know, building fast cars is cool, and it's, you know, people just innately get that, and he's the only one doing it. Maybe I overstated, right? Not the only one, but he's the face of that.
Yeah, he just put some American astronauts, right, back on the space station. Like,
right.
He literally didn't have, before that Dragon spaceship, the space shuttle was decommissioned. Our own government and space program couldn't do it. It took an American company, SpaceX, to go and get that done. And that's the kind of, not everyone can be Elon Musk, but you can learn something from him, and we should be making mistakes with ambition.
Yeah, 100%. Blake, hold it right there. We're going to come back for a quick segment after this break. Blake Masters is my guest. You can find him on Twitter at BG Masters. We'll be right back.
This is America First, and I'm Sebastian Gorka. Let's get back to the show with Chris Buskirk.
All right, last segment with Blake Masters. Again, you can find him on Twitter at BG Masters, and I recommend that you do. So I'm going to give Blake, I'm going to give you one big question. We're talking about it's time to build. You know, if we know that we can't just sort of do little things around the edges. We want to make the country better for ourselves, for our kids, for our grandkids. We got to build. But what do we build? Like, if you're thinking about the big projects, the things that nobody is brave enough to work on right now, like, what are the things that you think really move the needle? And, you know, to take the title of your book, what are the things that that go from zero to one?
Well, I think one set of problems that too few people are working on, maybe because it's so daunting, relates to healthcare and specifically making people live longer and healthier lives. You know, there's a community in Silicon Valley that's into life extension. This usually freaks people out because, you know, you get all these arguments on why it's actually good for people to die naturally at 80 years old or whatever. And who would want to live to 100 or 120 or something like that? But it actually is almost just obvious that you want people to live somewhat longer and, or a lot, you can debate between 100 years and 200 years or whatever, but it's bad if people die. And in this country, as you said earlier, there are certain demographics that are actually experiencing, you know, reduced longevity, which is not, we're not used to seeing it. So something in the healthcare space is not working, and political reform is so fraught and hard. I think there's a tremendous opportunity for people to develop new anti-cancer drugs, you know, new anti-diabetes drugs. Alzheimer's continues to, and diseases of dementia continue to sort of wreak havoc. And I do think cures to these things are hard, obviously, but also possible, and only possible if you believe that they're possible and commit capital and can start big companies to go after this stuff. There's also a huge opportunity to not just extend people's lives, but extend the quality of life with the years that people do have. And so are there new you know, exercise modalities, are there new therapies, are there new, is there a social network, even on the bit side, is there a social network for people to come together as a community and exercise? I think the health stuff is generally overlooked. People try to build easier businesses that don't add up to something as impactful and monumental as extending people's lives and making them lead healthier, happier lives.
Look, Blake, that's a great answer. I mean, it's not just about, like, length of life, but how healthy you are during your life. And that's what this is all about, right? It's we want people to live lives of vitality and meaning, and part of that is staying healthy. Blake, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on. Blake Masters, again, you can follow him on Twitter at BG Masters. Buy the book, Zero to One. Blake, appreciate it. And it's been a great show today, everybody. Appreciate you having me sit in for Dr. G today. We'll be back.
If you thought 2016 was important, 2020 is going to be the greatest, most significant election of your lifetime. As a result, we've created a unique additional podcast with our regular guest in studio, former special assistant to President Trump, Boris Epstein. It's called The Battle for 1600. Join us today by subscribing to the podcast for free. Just look for my name, Boris Epstein, and The Battle for 1600.